it's not an option. It's a right. Cocked, locked, and ready to rock the world of the anti-gunners. You are listening to the guy who had to register his mouth as a full auto weapon. Bill Carnes and Two-Way Radio. The fight for your rights isn't for pansies. So buckle up for the ride and knuckle down with Bill Carnes and 2A Radio.
Yeah. Hello and good morning. It's a particularly wonderful morning today. Because if you're listening to the sound of my voice, that means the world did not end yesterday at 6 p.m. This was by the same goofball preacher who said that the world was going to end back in 1994. Well, thanks for basically not allowing him to be the conduit from the Word of God. I don't know how this guy's going to remain having anybody in his preacher, in his flock, I guess, of preacherdom. Wonder if he's backpedaling right now as you listen to the sound of my voice. You're listening to 2A Radio, Second Amendment radio show. We just shortened that down to 2A Radio. The website, as always, is 2aradio.com. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, and we're here for yet another edition of our weekly input for 2A Radio. Now, this is the time of year where legislative sessions around the country, in most states, start really winding down. It's also the time where the more sensitive bills, such as should we expand the rights of gun owners, should we restrict gun owners' rights, should we continue to bash them down, this is where you get the true colors showing out of your policing community. They like to call themselves law enforcement. I take up a real issue with the term law enforcement. I used to be a cop in Las Vegas in the mid-90s, patrolling the mean streets of Las Vegas. In two of the probably four worst areas of town, there's four pretty crappy areas, three really in particular, and I patrolled two of them, swing shift. So when everything's, all the lightning is striking and the thunder is roaring on a nightly basis. So I come to this position from a position of having been on the inside, a position of authority, if you will. Law enforcement means that you're going to enforce every law and municipal code, everything on everybody, and just hammer it down. If anybody's doing anything wrong, we're going to enforce a law. As opposed to policing, which is where police came from in this country in the mid-1800s, to try to keep the scourge of society from interfering in the day-to-day activities of the productive members of society back during the Industrial Revolution, back on the East Coast. Pennsylvania happened to be where some of the first cops came around. Now, law enforcement is a completely different mode, completely different mindset, and these law enforcement officials, police chiefs and sheriffs namely, this time of year generally get together and show their true colors, that they don't want you to be armed. They'll get together and they will support anti-gun measures or go against what would be a pro-gun measure, lobby against it. In this case, in this year, in such states as California, Florida, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Minnesota, Wisconsin, on and on. Well, in the state of Nevada, where I live, we have this. Recently, the Nevada State Enforcement Officers Association has announced it will support Senate Bill 231, the Nevada Campus Protection Act. The NSLEOA sent an email message to the Nevada Senate asking them to move this bill forward, an indication that it should be sent to the Assembly, and they will lobby for its passage. Introduced by Senator John Lee, a Democrat, Senate Bill 231 would allow individuals who hold concealed weapons permits to carry their firearms on the property of Nevada System of Higher Education without first gaining permission from the university president, which is currently mandated by Nevada law. It's been a long-held policy within the campus administration to not allow permit holders to carry which has created an environment where students, faculty, and staff are left defenseless in this gun-free zone. The Nevada State Law Enforcement Officers Association represents law enforcement officers and support staff from 22 state and local agencies throughout Nevada, including the Attorney General Investigators, the DMV Criminal Enforcement Division, the Department of Public Safety's Highway Patrol and Investigation Unit, and the University Police Departments for University of Nevada, Las Vegas, University of Reno, and Truckee Meadows Community College. Joining the NSLEOA in support are four Nevada community shares. Brent Trotter of Churchill County, Tony DeMeo of Nye County, who is my sheriff, Alan Vail of Lyon County, and Ed Kilgore of Humboldt County. These four sheriffs have stepped forward on principle to support Nevada's right to carry permit holders in spite of opposition by the Nevada Association, Nevada Sheriffs and Chiefs Association. So, again, that's Humboldt County Sheriff Ed Kilgore, Churchill County Sheriff Ben Trotter, Lyon County Sheriff Alan Vail, and Nye County Sheriff Tony DeMeo. And again, Tony DeMeo, Nye County Sheriff, I live in Nye County. He's my sheriff. I know this guy. He is a wonderful man. As a matter of fact, when he first ran for sheriff, he just started his third term. He said he wasn't going to run. He wouldn't serve more than two terms. Then a couple of people entered the race, very, very strong candidates to enter the race for what would have been his third term at the end of his second term. These strong candidates of which stated that they were looking to gut the sheriff's department. Now, the sheriff's department had been self-gutted. It kind of eradicated a bunch of the bad apples when Tony took over 8 years ago, a little over 8 years ago now. A lot of them, in the first year or two, retired, moved off, quit, whatever. So he's able to build a good, solid department. And it is a good, solid, constitutionally-minded department. Well, since the front-runner candidates were interested in gutting this department, Tony was urged by a lot of different people, both in his department and of the community, to run again. He did. He won. He did an excellent job. He ran a very good, clean, positive campaign. He is a good sheriff. I've talked with him many times. He insists that he be called Tony. He doesn't want to be called Sir, Sheriff, Mr. DeMeo, Sheriff DeMeo, none of that. He wants to be called Tony. And honest to God, it sounds as though he's actually a little bit peeved when people insist on calling him sheriff. You know, having come from a policing background, that's my inclination. I force myself to call him Tony. But a hell of a nice guy. Very constitutionally minded. And I told a story, it had to be better part of a year ago, about Tony's involvement in having the federal government actually put on notice that certain divisions of the federal government were not allowed to practice enforcement of laws in his county. They needed to contact him, and he would decide whether or not it needed to be enforced. Stay tuned, guys. More to come after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're tuned in right here to 2A Radio.
Irresponsible people have no business owning a gun or listening to this show. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
Welcome back. You know, I'm going to talk about something that happened in Philadelphia this last week. I had no less than 20 sources email me one variant of this or another. Now, here's the way the story goes. This happened back in mid-February. And this is a story that came out earlier this week in the Philadelphia Daily News, and it shows why it's important that citizens be allowed to videotape cops, as it can be seen that citizens' only way to fight back against cops is to have them on record. Now, this incident happened several weeks ago in Philadelphia to a guy by the name of Mark Forino, a 25-year-old IT worker who carries a gun on his hip at all times for self-defense. He got the gun after several friends were mugged. But he didn't count on attacks by police. On a mild February afternoon, Florina decided to walk to an auto zone on Frankfort Avenue in northeast Philadelphia with a .40 caliber Glock he legally owns, holstered in plain view on his left hip. His stroll ended when someone called out from behind him, "Yo, Junior, what are you doing?" Florino turned around and saw Sergeant Michael Doherty aiming a handgun at him. What happened next would be hard to believe, except that Florino audio recorded all of it. A tense, profanity-laced 40-minute encounter with cops, who told him that what he was doing, openly carrying a gun in the city streets, was against the law. Doherty says, "Do you know you can't openly carry in Philadelphia?" Oh, by the way, all of this is available on YouTube. You can just search it, Philadelphia cops, I don't know, whatever you want to search. It's open. It's all over the internet. It's all over YouTube. It says, "Do you know you can't openly carry in Philadelphia?" Sergeant Dory asked, according to the audio recording. Florina responded, "Yes, you can, if you have a license to carry firearms. It's Directive 137. It's your own internal directive." Florina was right. He was perfectly legal to carry the gun, but that didn't matter to the cop, a sergeant who is a supervisor. They supervise, in some cases, up to a couple dozen other cops. They run the squad. Florino offered to show Doherty his driver's license and firearms license, and the cop told him to get on his knees. Florino responded with, "Excuse me? Get down on your knees, just obey what I'm saying," says the cop. "Sir," Florino replied, "I am more than happy to stand here," when Doherty interrupted and said, "If you make a move, I'm going to effing shoot you. I'm telling you right now, you make a move and you're going down." Florino asks, "Is this necessary?" Well, it went on like that for a while until other officers responded to Doherty's call for backup. Florino was forced to the ground and shouted as he tried to explain that he had a firearms license and was legally allowed to openly carry his weapon. One of the officers yells, "You effing come here looking for effing problems. Where do you live?" "I'm sorry, gentlemen," Florino said. "If I'm under arrest, I have nothing left to say." Somebody called him an effing a-hole, and to shut the F up, is what the cop hollered. Now, these are the boys in blue that we call to protect us, right? These are the same people that we're supposed to call to trust if we need assistance. Well, the cops discovered his recorder as they searched through his pockets, unleashing another string of expletives, and you can hear him on the tape actually bashing the recording device, trying to get it to break or turn off. It didn't work. Florino said as he sat handcuffed in a police wagon while the officers made numerous phone calls to supervisors trying to find out if they could lock him up. Well, when they learned that they were wrong, they let him go. But only temporarily. Florino posted the audio recordings on YouTube, and now they are harassing him again. A new investigation was launched, and last month the district attorney's office decided to charge Florino with reckless endangerment and disorderly conduct because, a spokeswoman says, he refused to cooperate with the police. Well, he's scheduled for trial in July. If one listens to the auto tapes, it's hard to imagine how a responsible person could charge Florino and not the cops for the disorderly conduct, because Florino was polite, professional, and courteous at all times. I heard this tape. Now, they're charging him with disorderly conduct because he refused to cooperate with police. Now, when the police are violating the law, violating your rights, there is no disorderly conduct that can be shown if you refuse to follow their orders, which he was not refusing. He was simply redirecting statements, which you can do. Cops do it all the time. What is legal for the government but illegal for the citizenry is tyranny. I think I swept that around. It's what's illegal for the citizenry but legal for the government is tyranny. So that's what we're looking at here. Now, I live in Nevada, which is an open carry state. You don't need any permit or license to carry a gun. If you read the Heller and McDonald decisions, you don't need to have any sort of a license or permission to carry a gun. But legislators don't want to hear that. Lower courts are not upholding that. So what's going to happen, as we see it, is all of these different types of cases are going to inevitably, we're going to have to hear them at the Supreme Court level. They're going to have to rule over and over and over and over again, making their statements more and more and more and more clear to judicial bodies and legislative bodies and executive enforcement bodies below them what the Second Amendment means. Second Amendment ends with these five little words: shall not be infringed. Sorry, those are four words. Shall not be infringed. And what happened to this guy? It was infringed. All we have to do is go back to the Constitution. The very same document that every cop in this incident in Philadelphia stood there and swore an oath to uphold and defend. Perhaps they need to join Oath Keepers. Oath Keepers will help remind them of that. Now, the NRA has also filed a suit, as did the Second Amendment Foundation in Illinois. The NRA is funding and supporting a lawsuit that challenges the constitutionality of Illinois' complete and total ban on carrying firearms for self-defense outside the home. The case, which was filed just last week in U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Illinois, in Shepard v. Madigan. The lead plaintiff is church treasurer Mary Shepard. Isn't that interesting? It's with a church and she's the shepherd? Anyhow. Joining her is the Illinois State Rifle Association, the NRA's state affiliate. Mary Shepard is an Illinois resident and a trained gun owner with no criminal record who is licensed to carry a concealed handgun in two other states because Illinois remains the only state that completely prohibits all law-abiding citizens from carrying firearms whatsoever for self-defense outside of the home. Mary Shepard also became a crime victim. While working as the treasurer of her church, Ms. Shepard and her 83-year-old co-worker were viciously attacked and beaten by a 6'3", 245-pound man with a violent past and criminal record. Ms. Shepard and her co-worker were lucky to survive as each of them suffered major injuries to the head, neck, and upper body. Mrs. Shepard's injuries required extensive surgery and physical therapy. This, folks, this is why anti-gunners that say we should get rid of all of the guns and just call the cops. This is why there's holes in that argument. The major hole is, if you take away the guns, people like Mary Shepard and her 83-year-old co-worker will be beaten down and potentially killed, suffering serious bodily injury in this case, because the laws prevented her from carrying a gun with her to protect herself. The cops could have never arrived to prevent this. However, if she had a gun, this could have been totally prevented. Possibly with no firing shots at all. Potentially. But we'll never know. Stay tuned. More to come after the break. We'll be right back.
You're listening to a guy who packs a gun to shoot the bad guys and packs a mic to shoot his mouth off. Bill Carnes and Two-Way Radio are back.
Welcome back, everyone. Now, I'm going to read you a story which illustrates the dangers of having extreme leftists in office. Because when extreme leftists are in office, they will appoint and approve extreme leftists to the courts. Listen to this. Out of Illinois, overturning a common law dating back to the English Magna Carta of 1215. We're talking nearly 800 years. The Indiana Supreme Court ruled last Thursday that the Hoosiers have no right to resist unlawful police entry into their home. Really. In a 3-2 decision, Justice Stephen David, writing for the court, said if a police officer wants to enter a home for any reason or no reason at all, a homeowner cannot do anything to block the officer's entry. He said, listen to this, we believe A right to resist an unlawful police entry into a home is against public policy and is incompatible with, listen to this, modern Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. We also find that allowing resistance unnecessarily escalates the level of violence and therefore the risk of injuries to all parties involved without preventing the arrest. Let's go through this again. Extreme leftists. We believe a right being a God-given bestowment when you are born. A right, which is much more powerful than anything ever written in the Constitution, much more powerful than any sort of power and authority that cops may have. A right to resist an unlawful, illegal, other words, police entry into a home is against public policy. So public policy trumps a right? I'm sorry, on the scale of how important things are, public policy is basically holding up the bottom foundation, where a right is at the very peak. You don't get any higher than that. We also find that allowing resistance. Resistance is a right. You have no position to allow it or disallow it. That it escalates the level of violence, blah, 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 blah. David says a person arrested following an unlawful entry by police still can be released on bail and has plenty of opportunity to protect the illegal entry through the court system. The court's decision stems from a Vandenberg County case in which police were called to investigate a husband and wife arguing outside their apartment. When the couple went back inside their apartment, the husband told police they were not needed and blocked the doorway so they could not enter. When an officer entered anyway, the husband shoved the officer against a wall. A second officer then used a stun gun on the husband and arrested him. Professor Ivan Botensteiner of Valparaiso University School of Law said the court's decision is consistent with the idea of preventing violence. Really. He says, it's not surprising that they would say there's no right to beat the hell out of the officer. The court is saying, we would rather opt on the side of saying if the police act wrongfully in entering your house, your remedy is under law to bring a civil action against the officer. Well, I completely disagree. Justice Robert Rucker, a Gary, Indiana native, and Justice Brent Dixon, a Hobart native, dissented from the ruling, saying the court's decision runs afoul with the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. Quote, in my view, the majority sweeps with far too broad a brush by essentially telling Indiana citizens that government agents may now enter their homes illegally, that is, without the necessity of a warrant, consistent or exigent circumstances, Rucker says. He says, I disagree. Now, Rucker and Dickinson suggested if the court had limited its permission for police to enter into a domestic violence situation, they would have supported the ruling. But, Dixon says, the whole aberration of the historic right of a person to reasonably arrest unlawful police entry into their dwelling is unwarranted and unnecessarily broad. This is the second major Indiana Supreme Court ruling in this past week involving police entry into a home. On Tuesday, a couple days before, the court said police serving a warrant may enter a home without knocking if officers decide circumstances justify it. Prior to that ruling, police serving a warrant would have to obtain a judge's permission to enter without knocking. Now the cops can decide to do it. Now the cops can bust into your home, no knock, and in this case now, no warrant. Which means the bad guys can too. If you can't tell the good guys from the bad guys, who do you know to shoot? Well, I'll tell you this much. If the cops are doing a no-knock, warrantless entry, they are the bad guys. And my decision would be to shoot. And I would take this judgment in their own words. Oh, you have an opportunity to take this through the courts to be justified if you are wronged? Well, guess what? Your decision would be wronging me, and I would have to take your decision through the courts. How about that? With this same idea, in Phoenix, a Pima County regional SWAT team fired 71 shots in 7 seconds. 10 shots per second. And a Tucson man, they say, pointed a gun at officers serving a search warrant at his home. Jose Guerra, 26, a former Marine who served in Iraq twice, was holding an AR-15 rifle when he was killed, but never fired a single shot. This is according to Sheriff's Department, what they said this last Monday, after initially saying he had fired on officers during the raid the week before. 6 days after he was shot, few details about the investigation were brought that brought the SWAT team to the southwest side home of Garina, shared with his wife and 2 young sons. So few of those details are known. Guerrero's role in the narcotics investigation is unclear, and deputies would not comment on what was seized from the home. 3 other homes within a quarter mile of his home were searched, served with search warrants related to the investigation that morning. The address and the names of those people lived in those homes have not been made public either. The department says SWAT members were clear when identifying themselves while entering the home. Well, that's what the SWAT officers say. Tucson is notorious for home invasions, and we didn't want to look like that, says Lieutenant Michael O'Connor. Says we went lights and sirens and absolutely did not do a no-knock warrant. When 5 SWAT members broke through the front door, Guerra was crouched down pointing a gun at them. The suspect said, "I've got something for you." When he saw them, O'Connor says, Guerra's wife denied that he said anything like that. Well, deputies began shooting, and this Marine is now dead. Well, we're now talking about more and more no-knock warrants. We're talking about more and more cops shooting bad guys. And we don't know anything now that this approval that a judge gave for this warrant. First of all, we don't know if the warrant was written properly, if there's any falsified information, or if it was on there and real. All we know now is a 26-year-old Marine was killed by the cops, and he never fired a shot. Not that you have to be the first one to fire to have cops shoot you, but he's dead. 71 rounds, 60 of them in his body. 60. 6-0. Well, we'll hear what one Indiana sheriff has to say when we return from the break. Stay tuned. You're listening to 2A Radio. If you live in a state which allows Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories, and you either have an interest in or already own Class 3 NFA items, the process for an individual to own these items includes photographs, fingerprints, obtaining a letter of permission from your police chief or sheriff, and a full personal background check which is spread across the whole federal system. Until now. Forming an NFA trust eliminates the requirements of letters of permission and all personal data and background checks in purchasing and possessing NFA firearms and accessories. NFA trusts offer a level of anonymity as well as flexibility in the purchasing, possessing, and storage of your Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories. To learn more about forming a secure and flexible NFA trust at a fraction of the cost from attorneys, visit www.billcarnes.com and click on the NFA tab. That's BILLCARNS.com and click on the NFA tab.
You can have the alcohol and tobacco. Leave the firearms to us. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
And welcome back. Well, in light of this decision we talked about in the last segment about the Indiana Supreme Court saying, cops, do whatever you want. People you're not allowed to resist. We say so. In complete stark contrast to the Magna Carta, Declaration of Independence, Constitution of the United States, many multiple rulings by the Supreme Court of the United States. Well, an Indiana sheriff says, if we need to conduct random house-to-house searches, we will. According to Newton County, Indiana Sheriff Don Hartman Sr., random house-to-house searches are now possible and could be helpful following the Barnes v. State of Indiana Supreme Court ruling issued on May 12th. When asked three separate times due to the outstanding callousness as it relates to trampling the inherent natural rights of Americans, he emphatically indicated that he would use random house-to-house checks, adding he felt people would welcome random searches if it means capturing a criminal. You got to be kidding me. Nazi Germany all over again. Random house-to-house searches. Speaking under the condition of anonymity, a local police chief with 30 years' experience in law enforcement directly contradicted the Newton County Sheriff's blatant disregard for privacy and liberty, stating that as an American first, such an action is unconscionable and that his allegiance is to the Indiana and federal constitutions respectively. However, he also concurred that the ruling does not allow for police to randomly search homes should a department be under order by state or federal officials or under a department's own accord. The Supreme Court of Indiana's ruling was, in case it happens, not Indiana police, go ahead and warrantless searches all around. That was not what happened. Just those statements can get this guy sued. Now, of course, at this time, we're still waiting for comments from many other state offices. However, the spokesman for the Indiana Attorney General took umbrage at what he referred to as large assumptions regarding police power, and at this time has no comment. He did, however, indicate that should the Indiana Attorney General, Greg Zoeller, feel it necessary to make a statement, that, of course, the different reporters would be included in the distribution of the release. Can you imagine that a sheriff has taken that decision so far off of kilter that he says, if he needs to, he's going to conduct warrantless, random house-to-house searches? Now, regardless of the failure of the Indiana Supreme Court to rule properly in this case, if I lived in this man's county and he was in the process of random house-to-house searches, and I caught wind of this, by the time they got to mine, what I would do, I'd shoot every single one of them. That's just me. Because there's another Supreme Court decision. In fact, there's four. I read them on the air last fall. There's four United States Supreme Court decisions that says, if you injure or kill a police officer who is violating your rights and escalating the violence to the point where you are in fear of death or serious bodily injury from them due to their unlawful actions, the very most you could possibly be charged with is manslaughter. That's with one of the cases. The other three cases say no violation of law occurs. Those came after the manslaughter one. So, you take the most recent decisions out of the Supreme Court of the United States, that's what they said. Now, that doesn't mean that you go out there, create some sort of a problem with the cop, he pushes his authority, and then you shoot him down. Doesn't work that way. That's instigating the entire thing. We're talking if you're just plain innocent, things are going on. Well, that's what the Supreme Court says, and they are well above the Indiana State Supreme Court. Well, the Indiana State Supreme Court has also been receiving many threats following their warrantless search dicta. The Indiana Supreme Court has received numerous threats via telephone and email, following their controversial decision handed down last Thursday on May 12th that authorities that authorizes police to search homes randomly, according to Indiana Supreme Court spokeswoman Catherine Dolan. In that 3-2 ruling, as we discussed in Barnes versus State of Indiana, Justice Stephen David, appointed by Governor Mitch Daniels, wrote that under modern, as in post-Patriot Act, jurisprudence, the folks in Indiana must submit to the violent force of any and all unlawful searches instigated by law enforcement. The court justifies such intrusion due to the individuals having better access to courts than at the elevation of the right to common law. Now, a natural inherent right of humanity, first acknowledged in the English Magna Carta in 1215, the Indiana Supreme Court decreed both the Fourth Amendment to the Federal Constitution and Section 11 of the Indiana State Constitution effectively null and void, although no mention was given to Indiana's governing document, despite it being directly in the line of fire. Moving on to California, the state assembly has passed an assembly bill which would, if becomes law, ban open carry of the unloaded guns. In California, here's the law. You can carry an exposed handgun as long as it's unloaded. No ammo in the gun at all. If you have a semi-auto, no magazine in the magazine well. No ammo in the chamber. If it's a revolver, all cylinders are empty. If it's a Derringer, nothing other. So, unloaded gun, completely unloaded. Now, say for instance you have a semi-auto, you can carry the ammo with you, on you, so you could pull the gun, insert a magazine, run the action, and be able to go. That's a skill. That's a skill under any sort of duress. But that's the way you can carry in California. The last couple of years, a vast number of groups, organized or just buddies, have been carrying openly in California to raise attention to this. Well, this last Monday, the California Assembly approved a bill to prohibit openly carrying unloaded guns in public after a debate that pitted gun rights proponents against who? Chiefs of police. They're interested in officer safety, not public safety. The bill AB 144 would make it a misdemeanor to carry an exposed and unloaded gun in a public place, street, or vehicle, except in some unincorporated areas. Of course, it was approved by the House by a wide majority, 45-29, largely along party lines. And now it moves on to the state Senate. Several states ban openly carrying handguns, and at least one applies the ban to unloaded weapons. The NRA was one of several groups that opposed the California bill and reportedly plans to sue if it becomes law. The bill's author, Democrat Assemblyman Anthony Portantonio, or whatever, of La Canada Flinteridge, said it will improve public safety. It is supported by the California Police Chiefs Association and the Brady Campaign to screw every American out of owning a gun. I think that's their official name. Now, improve public safety. Public safety means police. Supported by the California Police Chiefs Association for officer safety. Now, how many cops are actually in the state of California? I don't know the answer, but let's grasp at a number. Let's say 15,000. How many people live in the state of California? Oh, I'm not exactly sure, but I'm going to default to around 10 million. So the California Police Chiefs Association is lobbying on the behalf of 15,000 people at the behest of the public safety of the community safety of roughly 10 million. Fire every one of them. Let's see, they say families shouldn't have to fear for their safety if they're out for a walk and see someone packing a pistol. And police shouldn't have to answer calls to respond to those fears. Okay. What we're missing here is the misplaced fear in the first place. He said a loophole in current law allows people to carry unloaded weapons in public, even if they're carrying ammunition on the same belt. You don't need a handgun to order a cheeseburger, he said. You know, you don't need a cell phone to order a cheeseburger either. You don't need to be unreasonably searched and seized prior to ordering a cheeseburger. But guess what? We're allowed to have these sorts of things. There's some constitutionally protected rights involved. We don't need to be wearing a crucifix or have a tattoo of a cross or a Star of David to order a cheeseburger either. But we can, and you can't do anything about it. Of course, the opponents of this bill are saying, you're disarming our citizens while doing little to disarm criminals. It's not just the right to keep, it's the right to bear arms. Of course, backers insist the bill wasn't aimed at hunters and others who responsibly exercise their rights, and insisted it would make police and the public safer by reducing armed confrontations, calling it a public safety issue. The scumbag, hardcore leftists always go by the public safety, but public safety by definition is that of police safety. It's an empty argument. Stay tuned. More coming at you in hour two.
Gun control, loved by dictators since 1917. The two-way radio show with Bill Carnes is back.
Welcome back from the break. Welcome to hour two. By the way, I want to open hour two by wishing my best friend, Ed Winchester, a happy birthday. Ed's birthday was actually yesterday, 21st. He has sat in, for those of you who have listened to the show, usually once a year we sit together for a week on the beach and do the show together. And it's always a great time. It's always great shows. And Ed's birthday, so happy birthday, buddy. The U.S. Supreme Court has asked the Court of Maryland why the Second Amendment, in their view, applies only to one's home in light of the Heller and McDonald decisions. It was a busy day for the Second Amendment this last week. The California Assembly voted 45-29 to ban openly carried handguns in the state. On the same day that a federal district judge reaffirmed our right to openly carry a loaded firearm in public based on the Heller and McDonald decisions. Despite the worst efforts by the Brady Center, there's been, and various other anti-gun groups, no federal court has issued a binding or persuasive decision that the Second Amendment applies only to one's home. However, the Supreme Court of Maryland did just that in the case of Williams v. Maryland. The Maryland Supreme Court unanimously held that the Second Amendment applies only to one's home, and in a slap to the face of the U.S. Supreme Court Justice Scalia, who wrote the Heller opinion, the Maryland High Court criticized the wording of Scalia's decision. Wow, that's a little ballsy. Noted Second Amendment scholar, author, and attorney Stephen Halbrook, he decided to represent Williams, who was sentenced to 3 years in prison for having a loaded handgun in a bag he was transporting from his girlfriend's house to his own home. Maryland law provides for licenses to carry firearms, openly and concealed, but refuses to issue them. Holbrook has asked the U.S. Supreme Court to review the Maryland Supreme Court decision and answer the following question. The question being, whether peaceably carrying or transporting a registered handgun outside the home without a carry permit that is unobtainable by ordinary law-abiding citizens is outside the scope of the right of the people to keep and bear arms protected by the Second Amendment to the United States Constitution. The U.S. Supreme Court ignores most requests to hear a case. This time, the U.S. Supreme Court explicitly asked the Maryland Supreme Court to answer the question. It only takes four justices to vote to decide to hear a case. Both Heller and McDonald decisions were decided by a 5-4 majority. Given that Scalia was singled out for criticism by the Maryland Supreme Court, odds are better than even that this Supreme Court is that this case is going to be a high court calendared case. The Maryland Supreme Court has 1 month to deliver its response to the U.S. Supreme Court, and we'll see how that goes. Now, we also know that Mayor Michael Scumbag Idiot Bloomberg out of New York City takes money, public money, pays private detectives to fly all over the country and do entrapment audio stings of people who are selling guns, buying and selling guns at gun shows that aren't violating any laws. Well, he's done this in Missouri a few times. Well, Missouri House Bill 294 is a piece of legislation that would make a wide range of changes to Missouri's gun laws. It was passed just this last Friday, and it's now on Governor Nixon's desk. Up till now, this we have focused on pretty much exclusively one aspect of the bill, the fact that it lowers the age of eligibility for a concealed carry permit from 23, which is the oldest in the nation, to the much more standard 21. Well, House Bill 294 covers a lot more ground. Although it's easy to miss a section, and indeed, we're going to cover it now. What it does is it will kick Mayor Bloomberg's sting operations out of Missouri. It says in the following from the text, a person commits the crime of fraudulent purchase of a firearm if such person A, knowingly solicits, persuades, encourages, or entices a licensed dealer or private seller of firearms or ammunition to transfer a firearm or ammunition under circumstances which the person knows would violate the laws of the state or the United States, or two, provides a licensed dealer or private seller of firearms or ammunition what the person knows to be materially false information with intent to deceive the dealer or seller about the legality of a transfer of a firearm or ammunition, or three, willfully procures another to violate the provisions of Section 1 or 2 of this section we just talked about. And fraudulent purchase of a firearm under this section is a Class D felony. That's prison time. That's minimum of a year. In other words, it bans Bloomberg-style and Brady campaign-style gun show sting operations, as they call it, in which the mayor sends private detectives to gun shows and gun shops in other states at enormous expense, courtesy of the New York City taxpayers. There, they secretly record what Bloomberg presents as being irresponsible, unscrupulous, and dangerous gun sales in order to justify more gun control laws, such as laws to close the mythical gun show loophole. Now, if Governor Nixon signs House Bill 294 into law, Bloomberg would be committing a felony were he to try to send one of his stings into Missouri. It's not only his agent that's doing it, but his agent is told to do it by Bloomberg, who would be committing a felony. Governor Nixon's signature on the bill is not a slam dunk, however, given his not-too-encouraging history in regard to different gun rights. On the other hand, a St. Louis Post-Dispatch editorial points out, in very disapproving terms, that the broad bipartisan support for the bill in both houses of the Missouri legislature, it was 124-33 in the House and 27-6 in the Senate, is more than enough to override a veto. Now, lawmakers have served their masters at the National Rifle Association by passing their HB 294, as the naysayers would say it, by veto-proof margins. Governor Jay Nixon has it on his desk. Hopefully he'll sign it. Now, it's good legislation, not just for lowering the age of a concealed weapons permit to that of 21. I don't know why they select 21. You're an adult at 18. 21 is when you're no longer a minor. You can actually go drink. They want adult minors to not be able to protect themselves? All right. I'm not so sure I completely agree with that one. But in this case, it's also going to smack the face, smack the whiny little crybaby behind of scumbag, leftist, anti-gun, un-American, socialist, commie, scumbag Michael Bloomberg, right across his delicate little fanny. So hopefully next week I'll be able to tell you that it was signed into law in Missouri. Stay tuned, guys. There's more to come. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're tuned in right here to 2A Radio.
Tell everyone in the room to pipe down. 2A Radio with Bill Carnes is back.
And welcome back from the break, everyone. Obviously, one of the biggest failures in the history of this country has been the war on drugs. Okay, this was launched back in the Reagan administration. We have 30 years of losing the war on drugs. Now, we use the 80-20 rule because it works out so well in society, works out so well historically, and in this case, it is quite factual that 80% of all crime is committed by about 20% of the criminals. And about 80% of all crime is committed to support drugs or alcohol, much more so drugs than alcohol, about 80-20. So we have all these 80-20s working. This is just historical fact. This is the way it is. You look at all of the different numbers that come out of the Justice Department where they put all these things together. And this is basically what we come up with percentages. Now, if 80% of all crime is going to take care of someone's drug or alcohol problem, and 80% of that is drugs, then we've lost the war on drugs because these numbers haven't changed. They have not changed. Now, I'm not a big fan of drugs whatsoever. I have never in my life ever had any form of illegal drug in my body ever. I've never even taken a marijuana hit, not a once. I'm 41 years old. I only know one other adult human being. I'm sorry, make that two. Two other adult human beings who have never in their life ever had any kind of drugs in their system ever. Not even a hit off of a joint. Three of us that I'm aware of. Now, some of you might be out there listening and might be in the same boat. It's not so much that I'm incredibly against it. It's just, it wasn't for me. You know, I don't want to zone out. You know, if I want to catch a buzz, if you will, you know, I'll have a couple of drinks. I'll let it soak in. Everything will be fine. I know what to expect. You know, there's all different types of marijuana out there. There's cocaine with different stuff that's cut into it. Heroin, you never know what you're getting. It's all over the map. And if somebody gives you a hot load or something that's cut with or mixed with something that can kill you, which most of them are, cocaine uses kerosene to actually be filtered. You know, these sorts of highs, you're putting tremendously dangerous industrial chemicals into your system, which is where part of the high comes from. I'm just not interested in having those sorts of things in my body. I'm really not. I don't know what I'm getting, and I don't know what the effect is going to be. I just don't. So, with that being said, that's just my own 2 cents worth of it. But to have a war on these drugs, yeah, we've lost it. Now, imagine this. If the war on drugs ended, and it was up to the states on how they wanted to deal with drugs, they could make them legal, illegal, whatever they wanted. If they were legalized, they could say, okay, well, these are compounds that they're disallowed. You can't have these compounds in there. You could actually make legalized compounds. And then you wouldn't have to worry about all of the war on drugs. Now, the war on drugs has done this in this last week. The Supreme Court gave police more power to break into homes or apartments in search of illegal drugs when they suspect the evidence is otherwise potentially being destroyed. Ruling in a Kentucky case this last Monday, the justices said that officers who smell marijuana, who's like, marijuana is like the lowest end of the illegal drug scale. Like there's marijuana and then there's everything else. Officers who smell marijuana and loudly knock on the door may break in if they hear sounds that suggest the residents are scurrying to hide the drugs. Really? Hide the drugs or destroy the drugs? What is it? Hiding the drugs, all you need is a drug dog to find them. That's pretty easy. And they must knock loudly. So that means it's up to the cops. How they write it up in their report. We've talked about this. It's not what really happens with the cops. It's the way they write it up as to what they claim happened. Now, residents who, quote, attempt to destroy evidence have only themselves to blame when police burst in, said Justice Samuel Alito, for an 8-1 majority. The dissenter, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, said she feared the ruling gave police an easy way to ignore Fourth Amendment protections against unreasonable search and seizures. She said the amendment's core requirement is that officers have probable cause and a search warrant before they break into a house. Ginsburg asked, how secure do our homes remain if police, armed with no warrant, can pound on doors at will and forcibly enter? Well, an expert on criminal searches said the decision would encourage the police to undertake knock-and-talk raids. Quote, I'm surprised the Supreme Court would condone this, that if the police hear suspicious noises inside, they can break in. I'm even more surprised that nearly all of them went along, said John Wesley Hall, a criminal defense lawyer in Little Rock, Arkansas. In the past, the court has insisted that homes are special preserves. As Alito said, the Fourth Amendment has drawn a firm line at the entrance to the house. One exception to the search warrant rule involves an emergency, such as screams coming from inside the house. Police may also pursue a fleeing suspect who enters a resident. Now, the Kentucky case began when police in Lexington sought to arrest a man who had sold crack cocaine to an informer. They followed the man into an apartment building, but they lost contact with him. They smelled marijuana coming from one apartment. Though it turned out not to be the apartment of their suspect, they pounded on the door, called police, and heard people moving inside. At this, the police officers announced they were coming in and broke down the door. Instead of the original suspect, they found Hollis King smoking a joint and arrested him. They also found powder cocaine. King was convicted of drug trafficking and sentenced to 11 years in prison. The Supreme Court ruled in Kentucky v. King that the officer's conduct, quote, was entirely lawful, and they were justified in breaking in to prevent the destruction of evidence. Quote, when law enforcement officers who are not armed with a warrant knock on a door, they do no more than any private citizen may do, Alito wrote. A resident need not respond, he added. But the sounds of people moving and perhaps toilets being flushed could justify police entering without a warrant. The ruling was not a final loss for King. The justice says Kentucky State Court should consider again whether police had faced an emergency situation in the case. Really. Our own Supreme Court has now issued a kangaroo court decision. Un-be-freaking-leavable. It's interesting that it was not the government that created the Constitution. It was the people who created the Constitution, and the Constitution allowed for a government. The Constitution binds, controls, and constricts and restricts the government. But when you allow the government to interpret said constitution, they'll interpret it in their favor, which is exactly what happened here. I am immensely disappointed in the Supreme Court, with the exception of Justice Ginsburg in this particular decision. Unbelievable. Stay tuned. More to come after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're tuned in right here to 2A Radio.
Right to listen and take action shall not be infringed. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
Welcome back. Well, a whole bunch of fallout is coming in the wake of this Project Gunrunner scandal at the ATF. Representative Issa says that Gunrunner hearings will be held, and the ATF is cleaning house in Phoenix. ATF has named a new special agent in charge, or SAC, S-A-C, in Phoenix, the office from where the controversial Operation Fast and Furious arm of Project Gunrunner was launched. Meanwhile, Congressman Daryl Issa, chairman of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, has suggested that hearings on the controversial Project Gunrunner will be held in D.C. Now, heading up the Phoenix ATF field office is Tom Brandon, recently assigned to Detroit. Described by ATF sources as an excellent agent who will straighten out the mess created in Phoenix by Gunrunner architects, he replaces William Newell, on whose watch Gunrunner and Fast and Furious allegedly got out of control. Newell, meanwhile, according to sources at ATF, is now a special assistant to acting ATF director Kenneth Melson. They're talking about new ATF staff moves at cleanupatf.org. A source on Capitol Hill said that there's no firm date that's been set for the hearings, but that ISA does want to hold the hearings. That won't happen until the ongoing congressional investigations are completed. Right now, as reported by CBS News this past week, investigators are back on the ground in Arizona, where they were a couple of weeks ago. ISA and Senator Charles Grassley have both been probing Gunrunner for its offshoot Operation Fast and Furious, which they now believe are being covered up by the ATF. Imagine that. And the Justice Department. ISA said as much during an interview the other day with radio talk show host Rick Amano. He says, quite frankly, this is the way investigations often start. You have a mistake, and instead of administration owning up to it quickly, taking corrective action, they stall, delay, and cover up. And that seems to be what's happening here. Now, earlier, Attorney General Eric Holder appeared before the Judiciary Committee in the Senate and House, and following Holder's testimony, Issa and Grassley indicated that Holder, the top law enforcement official in the U.S., was not being entirely candid. He never is. He's a Chicago scumbag. Not to say people from Chicago are scumbags. He's a scumbag from Chicago, along with a lot of the rest of the administration, in my opinion, including the president. Now, in his interview with Amato, Isaac suggested a reason for this cover-up. Project Gunrunner, he said, was done with the knowledge of officials high up in the Justice Department. Here's what he told the talk show host. He says, the good news here is that the law enforcement personnel who are caught up in this, whether they were participants or simply became aware of it, are horrified by it, and we're seeing voluntary contributions of information, materials, and so on, that are causing us to begin to really understand the high levels of justice that was felony stupid enough to participate to make this happen so poorly. We're not done with the investigation, but what we know is that this is not a decision made in Phoenix or Tucson or Laredo. It was a decision made in Washington. Now, CBS News reported that gun dealers in Arizona are on the list of people to be interviewed while investigators are in the state of Arizona. Those retailers, according to documents attached to letters from Issa and Grassley to Holder, had expressed misgivings about allowing suspected gunrunners to literally walk out of their stores with multiple firearms. ATF offered assurances via email that at least one concerned dealer that everything was under control. Again, providing protection for the gun runners. Providing a conduit for them to get guns, and then running a protection racket south of the border. But everything apparently is not under control, as firearms tied to gun runner suspects were recovered at the murder scene of Border Patrol agent Brian Terry last December, and at the scene of immigration agent Jaime Zapata in February. ATF sources say the agency desk is being shuffled. ISA, for example, said investigators have gone to Mississippi, but it's too early to say that the deck is being stacked. So the shakeup, this whole shakeup, is coming in the wake of the gunrunner scandal, which the ATF alleged allowed more than 2,500 weapons to hit the streets or walk into Mexico. And as we said, Bill Newell, special agent in charge of the Phoenix office, has been replaced by former Detroit special agent in charge, Tom Brandon. See, two new assistant special agents in charge, ASACs, as they are called, have also moved into the ATF Phoenix office. Joe Anarumo of Miami and Tom Atterbury of Kansas City. Sources say they replaced the ASACs who oversaw Fast and Furious in Phoenix. That would be George Gillette, who's being reassigned to D.C. headquarters, and Jim Nettles, who's been tasked to the Phoenix U.S. Attorney's Office. Quote, this is unprecedented and welcome, says one insider who described the new Phoenix management as the A-team and as being respected. Another move involves agent David Voth, who directly supervised the Phoenix ATF Group 7 that executed Fast and Furious. Sources say he's also been reassigned to the U.S. Attorney's Office along with agent Hope McAllister. Sources say McAllister was the agent in charge of Fast and Furious, replacing Voth as head of Group 7. Is Steve Barberini of Miami. None of the managers who've been moved have had any disciplinary action announced against them, of course. The fact of their transfers does not in itself suggest any wrongdoing, but there are at least two investigations underway looking into how and why the ATF allegedly let different assault rifles, as they would describe it, and other weapons walk into Mexico. Sources say at the time, agents believed the guns would likely end up in the hands of Mexican drug cartels. Duh. One of the allegedly walked guns was used to murder, again, Border Patrol agent Brian Terry, and another, ICE agent Jaime Zapata. Nobody from the ATF Public Affairs or the Justice Department, which oversees ATF, would immediately confirm the personnel shifts. Of course not. They want to keep it covered up. And the DEA in Phoenix is reported to have stumbled across 50 to 60 Fast and Furious AK-47 type Kalashnikov action rifles. The ATF has been scrambling to contain their gift that keeps on giving. Within the past few days, DEA in Phoenix was surveilling what they believe to be a dope load. That means drugs, not stupid people. That otherwise it would have probably happened in D.C. A traffic stop was executed. The haul was not drugs, but instead 50 to 60 AK-47s wrapped in cellophane and intended for Mexico that were purchased during Fast and Furious. DEA has the guns, and ATF is reportedly scrambling to try to take possession of the guns from the DEA to avoid further bad publicity. Well, guess what? If you're listening to this show, ATF, you're already getting it. The DEA has so far not curbed to the ATF. Now, DEA and ATF work together on a number of different things, but I don't think DEA wants to be drug into this ATF mess. When you see somebody going down, and they're going down hard and fast and cannot be saved, you don't jump in to try to save them because they're going to drag you down with them. And it would appear as though the DEA has noticed this. Look, we're not going to hand you these Fast and Furious guns so you can make them disappear. You guys were in charge of padding the American gun store purchased AK-47 type rifles in Mexico by the Justice Department and the Obama regime. We are not going to get involved with that garbage and give you these. We'll hold on to these for our own investigation. interesting turn of events. Stay tuned, guys. There's more to come. We're going to talk about the ATF Death Watch right after the break.
If you live in a state which allows Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories, and you either have an interest in or already own Class 3 NFA items, the process for an individual to own these items includes photographs, fingerprints, obtaining a letter of permission from your police chief or sheriff, and a full personal background check, which is spread across the whole federal system. Until now. Forming an NFA trust eliminates the requirements of letters of permission and all personal data and background checks in purchasing and possessing NFA firearms and accessories. NFA trusts offer a level of anonymity as well as flexibility in the purchasing, possessing, and storage of your Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories. To learn more about forming a secure and flexible NFA trust at a fraction of the cost from attorneys, visit www.billcarnes.com and click on the NFA tab. That's BILLCARNS.com and click on the NFA tab.
As long as politicians attack our rights, Bill will be fighting for them. Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes is back.
Back on!
Welcome back from the break. We can chalk up several more deaths to the ATF. 3 months before Jared Lee Loeffner shot up Representative Gifford's community speech in Tucson, campus police at the college where Loeffner was going to school asked federal firearms agents to see whether they had any firearms information on Loeffner. It's kind of a funny, peculiar situation that gun control advocates focused on spree killer Jared Lee Loeffner's extended magazine after he shot Congresswoman Giffords and killed six others. Their fixation is like a drunk looking for his keys under the street lamp because the light's better. The real issue, why was this lunatic, sorry, deeply mentally ill person walking the streets? Well, we're sharing the fruits of its successful legal efforts to force Loeffner's alma mater, Pima Community College, to release over 250 emails mentioning Loeffner. And guess who was on the intersection between an obviously dangerous, erratic individual and guns? The Phoenix Division of the ATF. Now, did Special Agent Almaticio Valholasis stop Jared Lee Loeffner from purchasing a gun? Or look into his access to firearms or make some kind of move to prevent Loeffner from acquiring firearms by putting at least some sort of a watch or a hold on his background check if he were to go buy a gun? No, he did not. This is what he wrote the college. He says, "I did not come up with any gun info on this guy. Let me know if you need anything else." All right, well, I guess his agent and his Phoenix ATF homies were a little too busy just enabling Mexican gun smugglers. Clearly, the Loeffner killings were preventable. The bureaucrats at the Pima Community College were too busy trying to do the right thing to do the right thing. You know what I mean? If not, here's an email from Pima Community College Dean Patricia Houston. She says, "Yesterday, after the active shooter scenario training, I spoke to Officer Amato, who recommended that we file a report to open a background investigation. Officer Reeve responded and told me that he would begin the process to take the student out of the class and expel him. I told him that we were not ready to do that because we need more investigation." After active shooter training, the dean acknowledges the possibility of Loeffner going postal and then played a little CYA. Quote, "It's a matter of balancing the disruptive student's right to due process with the rights of other students in class." Well, back to the ATF then, which is supposed to be, for our final line in defense against criminal and psychos and criminal psychos, but obviously not Mexican drug lords, who want to buy guns and shoot the wrong people with them. As we've said before, the record clearly indicates the ATF so busy being proactive, setting up these lazy-ass stings, they've forgotten how to be reactive. Remember how Project Gunrunner and Operation Fast and Furious got started? Gun dealers called the ATF. And what do? They made the problem worse. Pima Community College sends them an email about a loon on the edge, and all they can do is run his name through the FBI's NCIS criminal background check system and say, he ain't in the system. How hard would it have been to ping a few folks in the law enforcement community? How hard would it have been to maybe pin just a little red flag on this guy in NICS because the community college said, we're a little concerned about this guy. Ping a little thing on there so it raises a red flag if he tries to go and buy a gun. Now, I'm pretty sure at least six families that should have been feeling very, very angry right now would be really encouraged, or I should say even estranged, to hear this information. Tens of millions of people out there in community who are pouring money into the ATF-shaped rat hole through tax dollars for no particular reason certainly need to have these answers made available. Or better yet, why don't we just disband the ATF altogether? And how about this? Since we've been talking a little bit about Gunrunner, or Gunwalker, pardon me, and Operation Fast and Furious, here's a new study that points to the truth about Mexican cartels' guns. The Woodrow Wilson International Center, which previously accepted as fact that incredible numbers of newly purchased firearms were being smuggled from the U.S. to Mexico, has just released reports showing that the numbers have been incredibly exaggerated. The revelation then shifts the blame from Mexico's drug cartels' problems away from America's lax gun laws and squarely in the direction of Mexican officials and Central American weapon smugglers and their corruption. According to the report, Mexican President Felipe Calderon said,
Mexico has seized about 90,000 arms, but ATF now reports that tens of thousands of the traced requests are duplicates. In some cases, ATF has received information on the same firearms up to five times as Mexican police, a crime lab, the military, and the Attorney General's office all write down information on the same firearm, and the individual in the Attorney General's office in Mexico City submits traced requests on all of them. Of the remaining firearms, the Mexican government has also failed to sometimes include basic information about the firearm, such as the manufacturer's serial number or the import number of many of these firearms.
Well, furthermore, about 26% of Mexico's trace requests to the U.S. government for fiscal year 2009 were untraceable because of serial number errors, and 75% of the firearms ATF was able to trace to the first purchaser in the United States were purchased more than 5 years ago. While President Calderon regularly blames America for Mexico's problems, ATF officials have sought to physically inspect firearms at crime scenes or at Mexican military storage facilities, but have had limited access mostly because Mexican officials or the Mexican Attorney General's office prevent such access, due in part to national sensitivity and lack of trust. The report also corroborates previously revealed information that, quote, U.S. military officials also report that more than 50% of the military-type arms such as mortars, hand grenades, and grenade launchers discovered in cartel caches have crossed into Mexico most recently from Central America. Nevertheless, the report recommends adoption of the ATF's proposal to require firearms dealers in the four southwestern U.S. states to file multiple sales reports on people who buy more than one detachable magazine semi-automatic rifle in caliber greater than .22, including .223. It also recommends that joint BATFE ICE investigations that are focused on smuggling offenses
increased penalties for straw purchasers, and, without explanation, higher quality license plate readers on highways out of the United States. What does that have to do with anything? How about this? Because of the violence in Mexico, the citizens there are taking up arms. 5 years into Calderon's war on the drug cartels, more and more Mexicans are tired of shop-worn excuses from a government which appears to be incapable of protecting the public from murderers and kidnappers. Life in a country which is increasingly being recognized as a failed state is leading more and more citizens to the realization that self-defense is the right and responsibility of every human being. That realization is leading to more and more Mexicans procuring firearms, often despite the Mexican regime's harsh laws regulating their ownership. There is a growing trend toward private gun ownership in Mexico, and it's a result of the Mexican government's utter failure to protect the people. Despite strict gun control laws in Mexico, crime scenes are riddled with bullet holes. Both drug cartels and common criminals have guns. Now more private citizens are arming themselves, illegally, for protection, even if it means breaking the law. "People are desperate," says one Mexican native, a private investigator who also lives in El Paso part-time, who's worked for clients just across the Juarez border. "They're telling the government, if you can't protect us, let us protect ourselves." Guys, self-protection is a God-given right. Do it.
I'd like to close by saying, to those of you within our government, we will be watching you in Congress, the executive, and judicial branches all very closely as we organize to save our freedom, liberty, and country. We will not become the subjects of governmental rule.
Thanks for tuning in. Bill will be back tomorrow. Now go side in and shoot straight. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes. Learn more about Bill at BillCarnes.com. Send your comments to Bill at 2aradio.com.